economics of freight. And so I'd like to welcome Pat Egan to the table and also give him an opportunity to introduce our guest.
Thank you, Senator Berger and members of the committee. For the record, Pat Egan, State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, and I have with me today Lance Grinsback, who is Senior Vice President of Cambridge Systematics, which he'll tell you just a little bit about, but it's a transportation consulting firm, does a variety of work. And we commissioned them a little over a year ago to help us take a strategic look at freight rail in Oregon. And as you know, and as you're learning, there's a growing amount of interest, not just because people are anecdotally curious about rail, but because there's so much congestion, there's so much volume moving, especially on the West Coast, in every mode, whether it's truck, rail, marine, and even aviation. We've got other congestion issues on the horizon there. We have other folks we could bring in, but Lance has been just very good in terms of helping us understand not just the regional and national dynamics, but even some of the global dynamics. And so that's some of what you'll be hearing from him about today. One thing I'll just add in, Lance was here, I think it was in August, maybe July, in front of the Oregon Transportation Commission in the Dalles, and that's part of why he's here today, is that I had so much feedback from Transportation Commission members who just said it's very eye-opening, very helpful to them in terms of just getting a fundamental understanding of freight rail, again, not just in Oregon, but throughout the West Coast and even the full United States. So with that, I'll turn it over to Lance, and he'll at some point be over there with his PowerPoint, but give you an introduction as well. Thank you.
Well, I'm Senator Berger. Thank you very much, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. As Pat said, my name is Lance Grinsback. I'm a senior vice president with Cambridge Systematics. We're a transportation and economic consulting firm. And what I'm going to do today is to report on the project the Pat commissioned for us, who worked with the port and then had great assistance from the Oregon Department of Transportation. And the question who was asked is, so what's the state of the rail industry in Oregon, and how do we relink investment in rail to economic development in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest? Cables won't reach this far, so we're going to pull out, and I'll stand over here so I can push the button and not get too bad with the loss.
And just for the committee, I believe you have in front of you the same presentation, too, so you don't have to necessarily wiggle back and forth.
Thank you. What I'm going to cover today is to take a very brief look at the forecast for freight for the region. And the short capsule summary is it's going up quite considerably, both for highway and rail. Take a look at the state of the rail industry, which is actually quite healthy and improving, but I'll argue that their ability to keep up with economic growth over the next 20 years is going to lag a bit, and there's concern that they may not be able to absorb all the freight that's going to be coming their way. We'll take a short look at Oregon rail commodities and flows. This is a very high-level snapshot of what goes on rail in the Oregon area. And then we'll work down to the talk about, again, from a very high level, what are the rail order capacity issues out there? What are the current and anticipated needs for rail to handle the freight that's going to be up there? And finally, talk a little bit about the possibilities and opportunities for a public sector role in freight rail. In the last 50 or 60 years, we've been invested in the public side very heavily on the highway system. And that's an aberration, actually. Most of the history of the country has been the private sector that's invested in the public sector that's provided small pieces. And the highway was looked at. Public sector invested heavily and owns most of it. And we're now struggling to sort of say, is there a public sector role in the rail investment again? Very briefly, we have some handouts for maybe more legible at that angle here. What you're going to look at over the next 20 years is roughly a doubling of the freight tonnage domestically and south, a little bit higher on international freight flows and lower internally. Now, the tonnage does not translate directly into cars and trucks and things of the road like that, so we have to divide out. But what you're looking at in Oregon is 90% growth in truck tonnage, doubling possibly of the rail tonnage, a lot of that associated with import-export, and a fairly modest increase in large traffic. This is pretty typical of what's happening nationwide. It's not outrageously high, about similar to growth we saw over the last 20 years. The question this time is, do we have the capacity to absorb that? And this diagram that you see in front of you, is what you see in the sort of gray inner circle of that pie is roughly representation of the tonnage we're handling in the year 2000. In the darker gray, it's the tons that are handled by truck. In the lighter gray, the tons that is handled by rail. And we fluffed out here at the barge and other modes. But basically, you can see the truck tons really dominate 80 or so percent of what's out there in the morning day. The question is not so much what happens today, but what happens in that outer blue rain, which is roughly the percentage of growth we're going to look at over the next 20 years. And the black blue is the sort of tonnage that has to be absorbed by the truck industry on the highways. And the original question, we did some work for the U.S. Department of Transportation and for the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials some 4 or 5 years ago, was not what about rail, it was what about highways. Do we in fact then pass in between zero on extra truck traffic? And it's not by and large the truck traffic that's the problem, it's the cars, because they dominate the traffic out there, but you squeeze in this many more trucks. The question was, what happens to your ability to keep up the pavements, to do repairs and such like that? And one of the things that we found when we were looking at it is that we were needed to be worried not only about the sort of lighter blue part of the outside of that donut, but the light blue piece that belonged to the rail. You said if rail grows and it, you know, accepts its share or it will carry its share of that growth, it should be fine. But the question was, does in fact rail have the ability to sort of bite off that new lighter blue piece? And the answer is probably not nearly as effectively as we want. The reason I said earlier people are concerned is because if you look at a snapshot of highway congestion, and on this map, or it won't show up on the black and white, unhelpfully, but you should look here. If you simply plot highway sections and you color them red for the highly congested ones down to sort of light green or gray for the uncongested ones, take a snapshot of that today. This is what it looks like. Not surprisingly, you know, the major cities pinpoint that it was highly congested. I think Portland and some of the areas out there stand out very nicely up in the Pacific Northwest. If you extend that out, and this basically is just extrapolating the economic and population growth. This isn't sort of fixing anything out there. If you extrapolate that out, that's what it looks like in 20 years. And I don't want to go back and forth here between those back and forth, but you can see we've got a pretty sizable jump. And the concern is not just in the metropolitan areas, but the concern is that this congestion is going to extend out into the inner city corridors, and where that bites is on the ability of the truck operators to move quickly and reliably between cities. So the question then being, well, if the highway system is getting increasingly congested, can't we handle it all on the rail side? And the answer there is perhaps, but not definitely. The major concern there is the cost. From the 1980s to 1980s, deregulated nationally, most of the transportation industry, in particular the rail industry, which had been slumping and sliding and ran out of bankruptcy since the late 40s and 50s. And what happened was on sort of a very substantial turnaround in that industry. It downsized, it consolidated its operations, completely restructured, began upgrading, and today the productivity of the rail system is very high, volume is back up, revenues are up, but not up, it's been thoughts. And what has happened basically is that we, as an economy, we've shifted toward products and a way of running our logistics operations, which favors running by trucks, which can tailor truck door to door is very effective. We've spent less and less time shipping by rail, less and less time shipping goods that way. And rail has been able to maintain themselves, but they've done it by downsizing and shrinking down to basically a core system. And the really large plots on the railroads today, the Union Pacific, and the Burlington Northern and others, are really focused on running long-haul operations, one from Seattle to Portland to Chicago to Los Angeles to Chicago. It's really a front-haul operation that depends on the economy to scale. If I can hook up 100 car trains to run, that works quite well. But if I have to do the local operations, I lose money when it's not competing. And so one of the questions was, do they have the money in this world to basically grow with the economy? But the Service Transportation Board, which oversees the industry, calculates is that their rate of return today is an enormous upswing. It's probably 8, maybe closer to 9% now. But the cost of money to the railroad on average is in the 10 to 11% now. So basically what this means is they have been able to replace, well, they'll replace buildings, but not grow as fast as they may need to. So you may see a healthy rail industry that is making money,
But it's doing that by shrinking the infrastructure that's out there, shrinking the number of miles and operating those very efficiently. But if it starts getting pressure to grow, it may or may not be able to generate enough money very quickly. In part because it's a very, very capital intensive industry. So 18% of rail revenues go into maintaining the plant, compared to like 2 or 3 or 4% for most other industries. And unfortunately, the railroad, you can't forget about maintaining a piece of track or bridge and expect to get from here to Chicago. So there's things there. So national study for the Freight Rail Bottom Line Report, what we concluded was that the rail industry today was stable, productive, and competitive, and that it had enough business to operate, but probably not to replenish and grow very quickly. As I mentioned, the cost of the infrastructure was huge, and they were really forced basically to downsize to what was productive. But the problem was that they are too being challenged by congestion. If you look across the country, there's about 4 or 5 big areas. The Los Angeles area, the Alameda Corridor coming out, rail lines coming out of Los Angeles, very congested. The East Coast between the North and South, very congested. Chicago Hub, where recently all the traffic comes in and then goes back out, congested. And the other one that made the sort of national list was New Coast, the Pacific Northwest, particularly the Portland Triangle, where the North, South, and East Coast lines interchange. Very congested. And the question is, can a railroad keep up with growth and deal with those congestion signs at the same time? If you take a quick look at Oregon, you say, what's all going out of Oregon? We took a look at two looks at it. One is to look at what comes in on the rail, because the cost of what you haul in affects the economics and productivity of your businesses here. You have to bring in chemicals and you have to bring in parts to build something. The more you have to pay, the cost of your product is, and less things like that. What you're bringing into this region, the top ones are chemicals, farm products, and what's labeled unhealthily, but miscellaneous shipments, which is basically merchandise for warehousing or retail. That's what's coming in. A lot of that represents in chemicals, a lot of that represents soda ash and potash that's being exported through the Port of Portland. If you look on the other side of what's going out, it's lumber, pulp products, again, miscellaneous shipments, this is warehousing, this is food, metal products. You look at what's going out because these are the products that Oregon is in effect exporting to other markets and it's bringing income for the Oregon economy. So you want to make sure that on the inbound side, rail is efficient, cost effective to keep the price down for manufacturing and processing, and on the outbound side, you want to keep the price down and keep the rail efficient so you can make sure you reach products without pricing yourself out of the market. The industries that buy most rail service across Oregon, you can see here, are lumber, road, transportation, and wholesale trade. The left side of the chart divides those out into statewide numbers, and then on the right side into the Portland metropolitan area, you can see that the things like transportation equipment, people like Glenn or someone else, there are several in the Portland area. Portland accounts for what's going on statewide. In areas like lumber, wood, and product, which is obviously spread across the region, rails are important. And wholesale trade and going to concentrate in there. So we look at these sort of purchases. Those are the industries that we're very dependent upon from the rail service. And then we said, well, okay, let's take a quick look then at the quality of the rail service today. What I'm showing on this slide, a bit confusing, but there's a listing of all of the railroads that are operating. This includes the long-haul class one railroads as well as your short-haul terminal lines that serve local areas. If you simplify that, this is a bit oversimplified, you can break these down into about 8 or 9 corridors. And what we've done is take a very, very top-down look at the condition of these corridors, the current kind of emerging issues, and those boil down, if you really wanted to sort of boil it down, what you'd worry about is about 4 or 5 of these corridors, and I will walk you through some of the problems with them. What you have here, just to orient you, is number one, the Portland-Seattle corridor is coming down from Seattle. The pink sort of through the center, which runs down the I-5 corridor, that's the main West Coast corridor. And then out along the Columbia River there, you have the connections to east and west. You can see that a little more clearly in the next slide, which is a snapshot from the Federal Rail Administration's picture of freight flows. What you see basically here is the red, the wider and redder band, at least on the color version, the more tons that are shipped on the rail line. And what you can see here is that coming through Portland and Oregon here, you can see the importance of the lines on the I-5 lines going south into California, and then the two lines, both branching north and south, that basically line up in the good part of the country, Chicago, for itself. So what you're looking at in the previous slide are the sort of first pieces of that link to the national system. If we take those apart, what we're looking at on the Portland-Seattle corridor that comes down is a fairly well-maintained line, but it is constrained now with capacity for freight and intercity passenger services, and as both are expected to grow, which means the line is in good shape, but the volume we're putting on it is getting higher and higher, and it's taking up that area. And that's one of the major north-south lines bringing freight down into the Portland Triangle. The Portland Triangle is the shorthand form that people are using to describe the complex of rail lines and interchanges where you cross over the Columbia River and connect to the terminals and the ports, and then to go southbound or on either side of the Columbia River. What we've got here is we're just basically reaching a point where the train levels are larger than the capacity we have. A lot of them are single tracks between the pieces, trains that will line up, wait to move back and forth. And what you have is a nice intersection that's jamming up. I think the study that was done in the Valley back here from the Akron Partnership figured that on a per train basis, we're about twice as much delay in Portland as you do in Chicago. Now, you have many more trains in Chicago, and it's obviously a huge system, but in terms of say, how well the capacity has gone up, the delay is about twice as much here as it is in Chicago. And I'll talk about later, Chicago is getting a considerable amount of money to unscramble their operations, so I'll take a look at that opportunity later. But this is a major junction, and so that basically affects everybody else that moves through rail lines and some of the other things. I can give you a sense of what happens there. For another project in the Department of Transportation, we looked at both truck and rail moving across the Bridge of the Columbia. This is a map showing rail traffic going across the I-5 through the triangle there. What you're looking at is in the counties, or called the darker the county, the more freight is generated or terminated in that county. So basically, the blacker, the more tonnage is coming out of that county. Or what you're looking at in the red colors are basically a measure of the tons of freight, rail freight moving back and forth. And what you're basically, the way to read this is to say that the bridge at the center of that circle there is a choke point. And the question is, who gets caught in that choke point? And the answer is, it's not just Oregon traffic, not just Portland traffic. It's in fact rail traffic that covers the entire Northwest, Pacific Northwest, and it's rail traffic that affects all the industries across this area, not just food. So you're looking at a fairly high quality, you want a very high quality bottleneck for the whole Pacific Northwest in that location. If you take a look, moving further south there, if you take a look at the Atlantic Valley Corridor, you have again a well maintained corridor here, but one that's constrained for a couple of reasons. Your inner city passenger services are growing. It's very difficult to run high-speed passenger and low-speed heavy freight on the same line and squeeze a lot of capacity out of the line. You have to leave. It's considered poor railroading to run one into the other. But the other thing you have out there is, and this is not just true, this area of crossing, is your short line railroads. And these are the feeder systems to the major rail lines. By and large, I said earlier, the major lines have downsized their operation to haul between maybe metropolitan areas. What feeds them these days are the short line railroads. And they suffer from two problems. One is that in many cases, the bridges are not adequate to carry the newer, heavier rail cars that are out there, and likewise the tracks in some areas. In the last 20 to 40 years, we've gone from light rail, so lighter rails, 263,000 pound capacity cars, 286,000 pound capacity cars, to get economies of scale. And in some areas, you're seeing 315,000 pound rail cars for hauling things up and bringing out of the Midwest. What that means is that most of the traffic now is on a 286,000 pound car. It's very efficient for the shippers, pretty efficient for the railroads, as long as you have the infrastructure of the rail to handle that. If you don't, you have to upgrade from the old stuff, you either can't take that traffic, or you have to spend a lot of money. And what's happening in a lot of the short line railroads is they're slowly upgrading in order to keep up with the national system, to be able to 82 will take from the national system. We need to upgrade and need money to do that. We move further south, most of the traffic that goes north-south goes down across the Cascades and then goes down to the Klamath area. Right now, it's not a huge problem, but that track through the tunnels is not cleared for double-stack containers. It's tall enough to take international containers coming on the ships, but not the domestic containers. The domestic containers are about a half foot higher each, and we stack two of them on to get an extra foot, and that doesn't clear the top of a set of tunnels coming through the Cascades. I think there's some work being looked into that. And I'll talk a little bit later about why that's important, but it means that you can't take the same traffic that can come out of Los Angeles or Oakland and go to Chicago. Can't go out south on this rail line, and I'll talk why that's a cost later. At the Columbia Gorge line, you have a water level route in low grades. It's very attractive to the railroads because you can move heavy trains, grain, potash, things like that, back and forth. If you go through Seattle passes up on the north, you can climb very high grades and come back down. Very costly for the engines to operate. The question here is, as the congestion builds, these are single tracks for the most part. They're probably very difficult to sort of expand them easily. The question is, what are you going to do? Because that's your main route out of Portland into the Chicago and Midwest area. Some discussion about what we're going to do in Brooklyn is a one-way pair, moving back and forth. But you can't do that unless you fix the triangle congestion. You have to be able to get back forth from one side of the river to the other. Because the north side is going to northern, the southern side is Union Pacific. So that's not, and if you're not running off sort of loop, you need to have shared rights there. What this means to your industries in this case is we're looking at lumber, wood, and paper products. They want to move heavy stuff southbound. Okay, and it's very efficient to move that by rail car. However, what you don't have is anything coming back north. But that means that if you're shipping something down, if you're shipping lumber to the big housing markets in Los Angeles and Southern California, you basically have to pay freight both ways because the cars, in many cases, come back at least partially empty. One of the reasons for that is that clearance problem down the Cascades. You can't bring back a lot of rail cars with double stack containers on them from the northbound. So you have an imbalance in the flows and difficult to make up the sort of things. If you're looking at it from the transportation equipment industry, what they're looking at is bringing in parts, particularly heavy castings for motors and engines and everything. They're looking at bringing those inbound, and they want very cost-effective movement of those castings, otherwise they come by water. Any congestion coming in, particularly in the Portland Triangle, makes it more, less reliable than home stuffing, makes it more costly, makes the cost of their products when they ship them out again fairly expensive. And then what they're doing in many cases is they're shipping the finished stuff down again southbound. And the question again is, how efficient can you make the southbound moves to get out there? Wholesale trade, for the most part, you're bringing stuff up from California or in from the Pacific into the Portland area, which is a major distribution hub, and distributing it out across the whole of the Pacific Northwest. The issue here is if you're bringing stuff north, mostly by truck now, and I-5 gets congested, the highway gets congested in the next 10 or 15 years, do you have an alternative? And the answer by and large right now is not really, because I don't have the clearance and tunnels to get double stacked domestic containers up, which means I either have to do single or I'm running by truck, which means that rail isn't going to compete very efficiently with truck, or if you have to use rail and truck and congested things, it means the cost of bringing it up and distributing it to this area goes up. Does that make a big difference? Well, I'm sure you can get it up here and you can work it around, but what it does is it means slowly but surely it inches up the cost of doing business and the cost of living in the region, and that eventually speeds its way through to sort of the cost of producing and exporting from the region. So again, we're looking at a question of how efficiently can you bring things up into this area. The food products industry basically depends on having everything move south down to the markets, so and all the processed foods that you get, strawberries that are canned and preserved here, they come in from China these days today, they're processed in this area, and then they're exported, many of them down to Los Angeles. The processed foods are heavy. It's nice if you can send them by rail, they're efficient, and you do it by truck. A little more costly, what's the opportunity to use truck and rail both in the next 20 years to keep those costs down? in the last thing we were looking at, the primary metals, a lot of the minerals in this region depend on scrap metal when brought in to be re-melted and recast here. And we'll gain, if you're moving scrap metal, is to move it absolutely as cheaply as possible. And the question is, do you have the rail capacity to continue feeding the minerals here? If not, it has to come by ship, and that cuts down the number of opportunities you have to import in water and keep this, things like that. Last is the farm products. We export huge volumes of grain out of the Port of Portland. That comes down that Columbia River Gorge area. It comes in a great wave of exports down there. And if you have congestion on that gorge over the next 20 years, it's going to drive up the cost of exporting grain. And globally, grain sales depend on a few cents difference per ton in the national markets. Over long term, looking at lower values, are the costs of moving grain out of this region going to be kept low enough to be competitive on the global markets? Or will the costs go up and therefore price out Oregon and Pacific Northwest farmers from global markets? But the point of all of this is not to say that there's a specific project out there that you have to do tomorrow or that the rail system is going to fall apart. It's in pretty good shape. The demand is up. The railroads are investing heavily. But the concern is that it will tighten up over the next 15 to 20 years. And once you start looking now, rather than waiting 10 to 15 years, start looking at now, where are the opportunities for the public sector to nudge that along? Are there opportunities where the public sector should be investing or leveraging investment in there to make sure the rail system survives and carries as much freight as it can? There are really two approaches that are being looked at nationally today. One approach is just to sort of let the market take its course. Let it evolve, depending on the fact that you can minimize state involvement, but that the market will drive the investment and we'll see the opportunities emerge for people to invest in the private sector. The other policy is to basically drive it a little bit faster than it would normally, to put money in on the state side, and that gets back to the question of where do you invest to get the best public leverage. Not all projects that are going to come to you on the rail side are going to be worth investing in. Some of them are going to be pretty miserable, and you don't want to look at them. But there are going to be opportunities where a small amount of public investment will catalyze a larger private sector investment, move it more quickly than it would. And you may want to look at this, whether it would preserve jobs, to keep the Oregon's economy and businesses in here competitive. And also to begin to think about the alternative if I invest in rail, is that we reduce some of our costs on the highway side. We're tightening up capacity on the highway side, so on the railway side, and we'll eventually be at a point where the question is not just highway, but I have a portfolio of highway and rail and water, and where do I put my public investment in transportation to get the best return on the public dollar, best return to the state in terms of its economy. So these are sort of two options that people are beginning to look at. The policy, if you want to look at a policy that promotes rail investment in the area, again, I would caution you that it's not going to be a magic cure. I would treat every project as a specific project to look at it off and stand on its own merits. There will be projects out there where no amount of investment is going to bring back the business, no amount of investment is going to bring back the people that are in this region, you want to avoid those. But there are other investments for the sustaining or growing industries that might otherwise slide around. There are nationally a number of people looking at this. A number of states have rail programs, the short line programs. We're beginning to struggle with the same question we're looking at is where is the economic return to the state for larger investments? There are a couple of very large ones out there. I don't think you want to envy these folks for the size of their problem, but you can watch them because they're going to sort of begin to set some things. In Chicago, the program called the CREATE project is a class one railroads, the city of Chicago, and Illinois DOT, looking at investing about $1.5 billion over the next 6 years. Much of that is going to go into separating out the commuter rail lines from the freight rail lines and unscrambling what happens to the commuter rail service in the Chicago area. But it's also going to benefit long-haul rail operations a little bit more. That has the benefit of being just all in one state, all in one city area, and it's involved under one government, so they can begin to sort that out. Now, what is a little bit more complex is the Mid-Atlantic rail operations. my case, you're working with Marshall Southern, CSX, Amtrak, and five states from the Mid-Atlantic, New Jersey, down to Virginia, trying to get together and sort out what to do with north-south traffic. You have this huge volume of traffic that's coming up out of the south and feeding New York and the Philadelphia area. And the rail system was never built to go north-south. It was all built to go east-west back in the 1800s. But now we have to patch back up because Red I-5, I-95, has become so crowded with trucks that expanding or double decking the highway is no longer an option. People are beginning to say, as a state DOT or as a state legislature, what's my best investment in the highway, in the rail, what proportion of both? So we're beginning to look at perhaps as much as $6.2 billion over 20 years. That's not been funded, it's still in the final stages. But going back to my earlier comment, in that set of funds, you're not in the top, you know, the $6.2 billion class. But if you look nationally at the kind of rail choke points out there, the Pacific Northwest, and particularly the Oregon area, it is right up there on the list. So one of the options you'll be able to watch is what do they do, how do they sort out the issue of where those investments should be, and what kind of lessons can you learn in looking at your programs. I think you may want to, over the next few years, take a look at defining, you know, how do you inch forward and define policies about where you should address freight rail needs, how do you make sure you relink transportation investment to economic development, make sure there's a strong payback for you, and who's responsible? How do you divide up the roles and responsibilities here? And the railroads are going to say, we'll pay for our part, you guys pay for the public sector benefits, we're going to have to work through over the next few years to figure out exactly what that means. You know, do you measure that just in jobs? Do you measure that in state economic growth? Do you measure that in trucks, capacity or trucking impacts on the road? The questions aren't particularly clear yet, but I think you'll have an opportunity in your Connect Oregon and other programs to begin to sort of take a look at these issues. If you begin at sort of local level, saying, you know, what do I do with a short line, what do I do with this piece of last number, and begin to sort through and look at the benefits of there, what will position you well in the next 3 years to begin to take a look at the larger network issues and say, how do I make sure this larger network up here works and sustains my rail operations in this region? Show an awful lot of information at you. That's the end of the presentation. If you have questions, I'll be happy to try to clarify or answer them.
On your Oregon rail flows map here, you show the basic corridor running through the middle of the country, essentially north through Salt Lake and then going up toward the Canyon and down to Portland. I was wondering, where is the nearest east-west route south of that?
Sorry, sir.
What is one of these?
The nearest east-west major rail route south of that Boise corridor.
You'd be coming out of Boise. I see it here. The next one further south. It's the one that comes out of San Francisco and runs on through Salt Lake, the original one across the translation line. And the other thing comes down here out of LA. So basically, if you want, you have to come down here and go east from that point. There is the other lines coming out, not shown or putting on this map. This is a map of Oregon traffic, and so we don't show the Seattle, you know, Washington State. There is, of course, you know, considerable traffic coming out of Seattle going directly across the Stampede and Stevens Passes. North of you. Did I answer your question, Chris?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Now, Senator,
following up with that, I assume all these different, let's say, lighter lines are just reflecting Oregon traffic on those rails as compared to the one that you pointed out that would be going through Salt Lake City. The flow from California there would be much heavier tonnage.
Yes, sir. Yeah, this is a picture of Oregon originating and terminating traffic. And I have somewhere there, or perhaps in the, well, I don't know if it's in the report, but we could get you. We do have a picture of total flows, and the ones obviously coming out of the Los Angeles area. But the volume coming out of Portland, Seattle, Pacific Northwest is still very, very considerable. And you play a big role in that. About half of, I think, the container traffic that comes into Seattle, Tacoma
actually comes down through Portland and goes out the Columbia Gorge route. So even though it doesn't actually come all through the port, you play a big role on the rail side of that.
Other questions? Well, I have a question, because I'd like to just hear your thoughts on this. You've given us a lot of facts, but what would you advise if you were knowing the facts as you do know them? What would you advise Oregon to do in looking at major concerns, in other words, in priority? We talked about the short lines. Those are absolutely vital to my part of the state of Oregon, which is over on the coast. We have a rail bridge that has to be crossed, but we have Georgia Pacific, Roseburg lumber products that are served by that short line. The other thing that's in the process of being done is a short rail spur to the North Spit, which is not going to be very costly, but will increase the ability of the North Spit to export. So, and then you talk about the southbound traffic, where there's nothing to bring it back. So you're paying for one lane, you're bringing empty cars back. Take a look from the bird's eye view and tell me what you see that Oregon could do and in what priority.
Okay. I guess, you know, as a general approach, the first message would be look at the large system, look at the rail system, not just for Oregon, but look at it for the Pacific Northwest, and in fact, look at it for the entire western U.S. Okay. Because it's operated that way today. You need to basically understand how the system as a large piece works, and then begin to focus down so that when you look at an investment in a short rail line or something like that, you understand what it's connected to and what it's serving. Okay. Beyond that, I would say that beyond the sort of short line needs which feed that thing, I'd say your biggest problem in the short term is likely to be the Portland Triangle area. That's your intersection between the north-south and the east-west rail lines. Whether the trip is started in Seattle on a short line in your district or coming in from the east, that's the catch point, that's the bottleneck, and everything that feeds through there is going to get caught and slowed down. So at some point, we're going to have to be able to sort that out to make all the other investments in the rest of Oregon pay off. Because by and large, when you're shipping, with the exception of some of the moves in the forest products, which moved from the forest to a mill, most of the rail that's being moved in Oregon is really going out a long distance. And rail these days is cost effective if you're shipping long distance by and large. So what you're looking at is investing in local fixes to short lines or in the Portland Triangle to make sure that your products can either go out long distance or come in long distance.
Sure, if I could just add a couple of things in. If the committee hasn't heard about it, there's been some good work that's been done on the Portland Triangle, specifically a study that was commissioned. States of Washington and Oregon were involved with both dots. It's called the I-5 Rail Capacity Study, and what it did was to look specifically at sort of that X point and say, what are the capacity improvements that would get us to not having the Chicago-like congestion, and how much would it cost for those projects? The good news is they narrowed it down to about 10 projects, totaling, I think, about $150, $160 million, a little bit more than that maybe. Some of the projects have already been done, and most of those long-term would be paid for on the private rail system. But as Lance indicated, part of what's being discussed here is at what point are you either priming the pump, moving the project along more rapidly, or just allowing it to happen. And at the end of all of this, I think for the committee and for all of us, is that first graph that Lance started with, which is first going to double. It doesn't matter the mode. Truck, rail, marine, all of that is going to grow very rapidly. And how do you deal with that as a public policymaker or as a public agency? How do you deal with that in a responsible way as opposed to just kind of sitting on your hands and waiting for it to happen? Because we're not confident, I guess, that waiting for it to happen is the way to go. But I think that's certainly something for the committee to look at.
I think I'm going to sidestep your question a little bit. The purpose of this study was really not to sort of prioritize projects. We didn't really get to that level. I think the key messages that would come out of this one are, it's time to think about the condition of the rail industry. It's time to think about the public's role in it, large or small, and it's time to sort of take a look at some of these potential problems, and because in most cases, to get them engineered, to get them funded, to get them actually constructed will take quite a while, and if you wait, you know, 20 years, you'll find that it's a much more expensive problem. So within that, I don't know, I mean, clearly there's a few areas, short lines in the triangle area, where emerging is problems now. How you rank order the others, I don't know. That's something that Oregon DOT, the railroads, and the communities should be starting to look at. And the argument I would make is sooner the better, and start looking at it from a systems perspective.
Well, I took note of your comment that there would be projects that would not be cost-effective, mm-hmm. that really we wouldn't probably want to go there. You have to realize that most policymakers do not have an inside track on the rail situation of how to improve it. And we're trying as a committee to gain as much information as we can. But do you think that it's too much to ask that the rail companies themselves help steer public policy in a way that is cost-effective in a responsible way, not only as business people, but in assisting people who are not involved in their business to better understand it?
I would certainly say it would be in their interest to do that. I mean, if you look at the rail industry today, it is under tremendous pressure to sort of operate cost-effectively. I mean, it is, in the 1800s, with water transportation was king, and the railroads displaced that because it allowed you to get away from the ports. In the 30s and 40s, automobiles and highways displaced the railroads, and that's been the case for the last 50 or 100 years almost. They're under tremendous pressure to make, their business viable. I think they're going to be very shy about investing in projects that can't return, make a decent return to them. So I think they would have and they're short enough of money, although there's a lot of it, short enough of money that they should be very interested in making sure that helping you pinpoint those projects and those investments that make sense. I can't speak for the railroads, but I would be certainly, if I were the railroads, I would be quite interested in making a clear argument to you about how to do it effectively.
Vice Chair Bayer is recognized.
Oh, thank you. I was thinking in terms of your the comments on the double stack, and I know that's kind of on the drawing board. It's been delayed a little bit to do the tunnels to allow that. But in the system itself, are there fixes all along the system that can help alleviate the problems in the triangle, or is it majorly just fixes in the triangle itself?
I'm sorry, is it fixes in the triangle or elsewhere around the...
Right, I mean, well, system. Fixes everywhere help also, or do most of the fixes for the congestion need to be done in the triangle?
I would say your early bottleneck is the triangle area. Okay. The other ones that we're showing in the diagram are probably not major problems today, but as the economy and the population in the Pacific Northwest grow, those have the potential to become the next generation of bottlenecks. And so I think if you don't fix the triangle problem or begin to address that, then the others won't really make a big difference. But you could stage it and phase them, certainly. How soon we would look at sort of when they become problems, but it's when you go around and talk to the railroads, talk to the operations people, look at the forecast and things like that, it's clear you've got an intersection problem, interchange problem right now in the triangle. If you solve that, you eventually bump into other problems, and nobody's looked at them in any great detail at this point. So the short answer is first that one, then begin to sort out the others. Does that answer your question clearly? I'm not sure.
I think so. I guess what you're saying is that's the problem, and all the other little problems around aren't, by fixing those, you're not going to help that problem at all.
Not immediately, no. But I would say that it's the trial. It's also your short lines. because that's the system that feeds the major long-haul operations. And clearly, if you have a mill or plant that can't get stuff in and out on the short lines, that undermines the demand for the traffic on the long lines. And that echoes back to the kind of jobs and revenue that support the Oregon economy.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I'm understanding your question, I think there are two tracks, if you will, two ways of looking at this. On the one hand, in Oregon, specifically, because we do have a fairly vibrant short-line railroad system that does, in many ways, feed the long-haul, but also provides a service and the essential connectivity for relatively low-value products to get to international markets or other national markets. And those are, we certainly consider them critical, even though some of them may not go through our properties one way or another. We work directly with the Cork Railroad, for example, which operates in both of your districts, just as part of our overall transportation mission, and because we want to make sure that they're healthy and vibrant. But it's I'm not going to say it's 6-1 doesn't the other, because I don't quite know the answer. But as far as you looking at places for Oregon to potentially cooperate with private operators, there are definitely a catalog. There's definitely an inventory of projects on the short line that could have both a good economic impact and be good for the transportation system. The one on the national scale, this big map that's been identified as the largest problem, is where the traffic comes through the Portland area.
I didn't.
Other questions? All right. If not, we'll take a 5-minute break and return to our public hearings on the Senate, the Senate Committee.
Thank you.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 56. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senate Bill 56 has, first of all, no revenue impact statement. We haven't received a fiscal one way or the other on the measure. You also have at your seat at the dais the Dash 1 amendments. Senate Bill 56 prohibits a person from operating a motorboat while any person holds on to or occupies any portion of the boat aft of the transom, and establishes a maximum fine of $360. The Dash 1 amendments add language to include a prohibition not only while the motorboat is underway, but also while the engine is idling. It deletes the prohibition against being pulled by the motorboat through the wake of the motorboat and inserts a prohibition against being pulled while holding onto any portion of the step, ladder, platform, or deck. This is to make a distinction with water skiing and other allowed uses. It allows operation and idling while the person is holding on to those sections aft of the transom for a brief period of time, thereby allowing entering or exiting the vessel or engaging in law enforcement activities. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do not have before me a sheet, so I would need that. Thank you very much. I'll call Paul Dunheffner from the State Marine Board, who will testify about Senate Bill 56. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Don Heffner, Director of the Marine Board. We requested this bill in the interest of preventing injuries and deaths due to carbon monoxide poisoning that have been documented recently by persons that are engaged in activities that are sometimes referred to as cheek surfing or platform dragging. These activities involve persons that hang on to the swim platform of a ski boat while being towed through the water. These swim platforms are sometimes made of teak wood, hence the term teak surfing. Another source of concern as well is the practice of simply occupying the swim platform while the boat is in idle. Attached to my testimony is a letter from Captain Jane McGammon, of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, which is a part of the National Occupational Safety and Health Group. That letter provides a thorough background on the nature of the problem and the need for Senate Bill 56. The CDC became involved in the issue of carbon monoxide poisonings involving peak surfing in 2001 as an outgrowth of work that they were doing on similar types of deaths that were happening with houseboats and stationary generators. The CDC has documented 49 severe poisonings, 17 of which resulted in death and 19 in loss of consciousness from persons that were occupying swim platforms or engaged in peak surfing. 1 in 4 of these poisonings took place while occupying the swim platform with the boat at idle, stationary in the water. There are a number of cases that they documented. One that I've highlighted in my testimony involves a 2-year-old victim who climbed out onto the swim platform while the boat was idle and her parents were preparing to water ski. She lost consciousness within 1 minute of exposure. Fortunately, her father was a family physician, was able to perform rescue breathing. And after 3 hours of treatment with 100% oxygen, she still had a carboxyhemoglobin level of 14.3%. Normal carboxyhemoglobin is less than 5%. And the CDC did back calculations on her CO levels at the time of exposure. We revealed that her exposure level was 50 to 57% immediately after the exposure. Unfortunately, she recovered. In another Lake Shasta, California case, an adult male died within minutes of resting on the swim platform with the boat at idle. His autopsy showed 89% of his blood oxygen had been replaced by carbon monoxide, and he died. Carbon monoxide, just to provide an insight into how dangerous it can be, it binds to hemoglobin with an affinity of 200 to 270 times greater than that of oxygen. At carboxyhemoglobin concentrations of 10 to 20%, symptoms include those of motion sickness or heat exhaustion, include headache, nausea, dizziness, and vomiting. At levels above 30%, or 3,000 parts per million, it's seizures, coma, and death would occur. At levels, and they've measured levels exceeding 50%, or half of your oxygen carrying capacity, have been measured in open air, open exhaust, in open air exposure in the area around this teak swim platform where the boat exhaust comes out. To put that in a little bit of perspective for you, ambient CO concentrations have been measured as high as 27,000 parts per million around these swim platforms. At levels of half of that, or even less than half of that, 12,800 parts per million, death occurs in less than 3 minutes. So there's extremely high levels of CO being released in that area of the swim platform. People holding onto that swim step, engaged in peak surfing, or just simply occupying it with the boat at idle, are clearly putting themselves in harm's way. There have been laws in other states to address this, most recently in California, Assembly Bill 2222, which was a result of two young people that died down there. It was two young teenagers that drowned that prompted the California Assembly to address that bill. Similar laws have been adopted in Pennsylvania and Nevada. Last year, the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators adopted a model act to address this issue. That model act calls for a prohibition on teak surfing or platform dragging and would also prohibit occupancy of the swim platform while the boat's at idle, with a few very narrow exceptions. We've worked with the Water Sports Industry Association, which is an industry lobbying group that promotes things such as water skiing, wakeboarding, and other things, to be sure that the language in this bill doesn't inadvertently affect those legitimate activities that people are engaged on in towed water sports. And there's a letter also attached to my testimony indicating that they're in support of the bill. The industry is very concerned with this practice because obviously it paints an image of all towed water sports being extremely dangerous when in fact sports that happen on a rope after the behind the boat don't have the same risk as teak surfing. We haven't documented any deaths yet in Oregon, but we feel that given the CDC data and the actions, the data that we know and the actions of other states, that it would be prudent to be proactive in this and try to get ahead of it here. We do have one minor amendment that we'd like to ask for the committee's consideration. It would clarify in Section 2 that the prohibition on occupying the swim platform includes times when the engine is at idle and the boat is not technically underway. The amendment that's been drafted helps to clarify that intent. It also clarifies the exemptions for occupying the swim platform for legitimate reasons or for only a brief period of time. With the amendments, we believe the bill will promote safer boating practices. It will complement the efforts of industry, various volunteer boating safety organizations, and our agency to educate and inform the public about the dangers of carbon monoxide and certain unsafe practices. We intend to incorporate information about the dangers of CO and various education campaigns into our website and other education venues as well. Marine law enforcement officers will be out there assisting us in that education effort to warn people of the dangers of this. And we would thank you for your consideration of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you very much. I want to ask a little bit of a technical question, and if you can't answer it, it's all right. But isn't it true that the reason that people die so quickly from the carbon monoxide is that when it's inhaled, it clings to the side and it's not expelled? Is that true?
Madam Chair, that is correct. As I mentioned, carbon monoxide binds to the hemoglobin, which is what transports oxygen in your system. It has a binding affinity 200 to 270 times greater than that of oxygen. So basically, it binds to your red blood cells, and it doesn't let go very easily. Even after treatment with pure oxygen for an extended period of time, you can still have an extremely high carbon monoxide level after several hours of treatment with pure oxygen.
I have one other question, and then I'm going to turn it over to the committee. But actually, people very innocently could cause something like this, where someone came up behind the boat and just got up on the platform while the motor was still running. Is that right? All right. Questions of the committee? Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I was listening to testimony, and it sounds like we're trying to take in the concerns, of course, the health risk, but also making sure that different type of water sports are not, let's say, negatively impacted. Is my understanding that if a boat comes up on the side of a dock and they're getting ready to have people come into the boat or whatever, depending on their location, they may have to shut the boat down while they're actually getting off the dock into the boat, to keep the carbon monoxide from being released from the boat as it's sitting there? Or is it only at the time when they get to a certain point to the back of the boat where the exhaust is at?
Madam Chair, or Senator Przanski, the intent here is that if people are engaged in boarding a boat, that the engine could still be idling. Some larger boats have a door to the swim platform, and it's easier to enter, egress, and enter and leave the boat by stepping onto a swim platform and then through a door into the cockpit area. And so that practice would be all right with this. We don't want people occupying the swim platform for extended periods of time. And what is a brief period of time is, that's why we're asking for the amendment to try to clarify that it's for a brief period of time. There's still judgment involved in that.
I'm just going to sit here and think about when we pass the 20-mile-an-hour speed zone anywhere in the schools as to are we getting ready to take on a new venture. And water sports is not one of my, and since motorized water sports isn't an area that I choose to participate in, at least in this part of my life, because I know that with age certain things come as more hazardous. And I'm just wondering if this is something that that the bill is cracked in a way that we're not going to get the fallback fallout as to trying to be so protective that we're basically having young ones shut the motors down and have to start back up whatever at any time anyone's coming and going off the boat or getting out of the water from a water sport activity.
Other questions or comments?
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony, for being here. The definition of a motorboat, I can foresee boats that don't necessarily have exhaust all coming out the back of the boat, where this is generally the problem. Is motorboat defined in such a way that it's such a broad category, Senator Kransansky mentioned, are we throwing too broad of a net to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish here?
Madam Chair, Senator Stark, motorboat is defined as, you know, any boat that's propelled by machinery. But really what we're dealing with in this bill are only boats that have a swim step or a swim platform. So most of your outboard powered boats, personal watercraft, variety of different kinds of boats don't have a swim step or a swim platform. They're not going to be engaged in peak surfing because there's nothing to hold on to. They're not going to be occupying a swim platform if there's no swim platform there. So this really gets at boats that are so equipped with a swim step or a swim platform.
Other comments? All right. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Is there anyone here that wants to testify that did not sign up on Senate Bill 56? All right. And we will move on to a public hearing on Senate Bill 101.
Senate Bill 101 authorizes a claim for relief against the Oregon Department of Transportation if certain approach roads are closed by the department. It applies to approach roads closed on or after the effective date. We have received a no revenue impact on the measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I believe we have Director Werner with us today and also John Jockley from the department.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, the Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I believe being handed out to you right now is a quick memo from myself to you on this issue. And as you know, today there are two bills scheduled before you dealing with access management, Senate Bill 101 and Senate Bill 102. These bills are intended, as you'll hear in a moment, to give the Oregon Department of Transportation additional tools to help us work toward acceptable solutions with property owners who desire access to our state highways. And John Jackley from the Highway Division will cover Senate Bill 101 in just a moment. But before it begins, what I wanted to do is just have for you, especially some of the new members who haven't been involved in transportation, to give you a little background in terms of what access management is, again, why it's important from the standpoint of saving capacity and wise use of funds, and really some of the things we're doing at the department, because I know a number of you understand that access management has been a priority of mine to essentially allow the department to be more customer service oriented and work with property owners to figure out ways to allow economic opportunity to occur and still have safe and mobile highways. So if I could, I just wanted to define, and if you read my memo, you can find out that access is simply a term that we use to describe a connection of a driveway or a public road to a state highway. And in order to talk about access management, I think it's important to talk about what access management is not. And under state and federal law, it's important to note that the Oregon Department of Transportation cannot landlock a parcel of ground.
if a project, for example, requires that we landlock a piece of property, we are required under state and federal statute to purchase the property at fair market value. And I think one of the things that becomes a point of contention, however, is that the driveway does not have to be on a state highway. It can connect to a city or county road, and those are some of the areas where conflicts arise. In terms of the background, I just wanted to remind all of us of the importance of the state highway system, because I think everybody knows that almost everything we buy, sooner or later, is at one time in this journey, is on a truck. And on I-5, I wanted to point out, you heard about the rail transport in the I-5 corridor, but on the highway side, an amazing 25% of all the imports and exports of the United States at one time or another are in that highway corridor between Mexico and Canada. And it's important to note that that large national and international perspective, we still rely on the state highway system to go to work, to go to school, to church, and to play. And all of the system represents about a $60 billion investment by the taxpayers of Oregon. And one of the ways that we try to manage it, and the least expensive way to manage it, is through access management. And this is where we try to balance the needs, for example, as I point out in the memo, of the log truck trying to get from one city in Oregon to another, to the mill, as an example, or the needs of a homeowner who has to stop at the bank on the way to the hardware store, or a parent who's trying to get from work to school and to take the kids to soccer practice. And these often create conflicts on our highway system. And if the transportation system was perfect, city streets and county roads would deal with some of those local trips of trying to get folks to the bank, hardware store, and school, and we'd utilize the state highway system to get from one part of the state to the other or through the state. But as you know, in many communities, the state highway is the main street of that community and has to serve all of those functions, and that's where the conflicts arise. So what I wanted to stress to you is everybody understands the importance, for example, of the interstate highway and its desire and function to get long-distance travel. Nobody, I don't think, would suggest we should put signals and more access points onto that interstate highway. But some of the other reasons you need to be concerned about access management, and one of the reasons we're concerned, is we want to make sure that our investments and the capacity of our roadways are preserved. And I pointed out in my memo the $100 million Bend Parkway, which was required to be built because the first bypass of downtown Bend failed because there was not, again, controls on access and management, and Third Street became congested and we needed to build another bypass in that community. And then finally, the other issue is safety. I just wanted to remind the committee that we know that 50% of the non-interstate highway accidents that occur on the state and local system occur at intersections between our highways and driveways and or streets. So in summary, I just wanted to say that in addition to providing access to private property, the reason we do access management is to improve safety for the traveling public, provide interstate and intrastate movement of goods and services, to reduce congestion, fuel consumption, and try to use our resources as efficiently as possible. And then the final last thing I just tried to make it clear is that the commission, I and my staff do understand the importance of balancing the need for access against ensuring movement of traffic safely and efficiently. And access management has and will always be contentious, but I wanted to make the committee aware that over the past 4 years, this has been a priority for me, and with urging from the legislature and with working with dozens of folks around the state or stakeholders in this, we have revised administrative rules to make them more flexible, to provide discretion for our local staffs at the region level to make decisions, and allow essentially our staff to make really what are common sense decisions to improve the safety and mobility of the system, but at the same time provide opportunities for economic growth and projects that are important to cities and counties. Along with that, at your urging, we have developed performance measures so that we're monitoring our performance in terms of effectiveness, efficiency, and customer satisfaction. I think it's important to note, last year I looked at the records, and about 95% of the requests for approvals for access have been approved, and our overall customer service ratings were about 70% good or excellent. And I don't think that's high enough. We're going to continue to work on that, but we are measuring performance, as you suggest, and we'll use that to improve our performance. So unless you have questions, some of the general comments I made, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Mr. Jackley and ask him to go over the reasons and the tool that we've provided by Senate Bill 101.
Thank you, Director Warner, for that explanation. John, if you'll give us your name and your title for the record.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Jackley. I'm the Executive Officer for the Highway Division. This bill is a good indicator of the direction that Director Warner is talking about, because Senate Bill 101 is about fairness to property owners and taxpayers. In 1949, the legislature gave ODOT the authority to control access to state highways, and in 1999, the legislature passed Senate Bill 86. Which allows the department to provide administrative remedies to issues that might arise by closing a driveway. The problem is that only driveways that have a post-1949 permit can do this. So if you have a driveway prior to 1949, and if it got closed, you wouldn't have this administrative remedy that's available to everybody else. You'd have to take the department to court. That costs, generally a lot of unnecessary time and money. So we believe that this bill provides fairness and equity to property owners, because it gives those that have the pre-1949 accesses the same kind of relief that's available to everybody else. It would allow us to treat all property owners with legal accesses fairly and consistently, and we respectfully request your support for this bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's open it to questions. Any questions? No? Questions? All right, well, you got off very easy. We do have another bill. I don't know if the two of you. Let's see, on this bill, though, I believe we have Patrick Allen signed up to speak on Senate Bill 101. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Just very briefly, I'm Patrick Allen, Manager of the Office of Regulatory Streamlining in the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We're a co-requester on this bill with the Department of Transportation. I'm here today to speak just quickly in support of this bill and Senate Bill 102 as well. These are two of the three dozen regulatory streamlining bills that make up our legislative package for the session. We've just passed out copies to you of that package. You'll find that these bills included range from big changes in policy to small fixes and improvements in regulatory processes. Probably Senate Bill 101 and 102 are more toward the small changes end, but even small changes in regulatory systems are the kinds of things that when we do lots of them, if we're successful in being able to do that this session, can improve our regulatory climate. I'd encourage your vote in favor of the bill. Thank you.
All right. Any questions of him? Yes, Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When looking through this bill, I understand that it's basically to help the department assist somebody who's lost access, that if they currently has access and for whatever reason there's a closure of that right to that access. And it says that the department may use and acquire by any lawful means not to limit, but to exercise the right of, or the power of eminent domain over interest of other real estate property holders. So if you basically close off property A's access to the highway, and property B owner has access that would also allow property A to get there, I'm assuming what this would provide for is for the department to go in and try to negotiate through a buying process a strip of land that would give that property a new access point onto the highway, and failing the ability for the department to do that, then they could basically just, through eminent domain, take over through a process of paying fair market value for that piece of property to give property A access to their property to the highway.
Well, my understanding of the bill is that it provides the ability to negotiate a purchase transaction. Beyond that, in terms of more technical questions about the bill, ODOT would really be able to answer that better than I would.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Chair, Senator Prezansky. I believe that question refers to Senate Bill 102, the next one that's coming up. 101 deals with the grandfather privilege.
All right. Are there any questions of the streamlining on 101? All right. If not, then thank you very much. And we can just stay right there, John, because you're ready now to move to Senate Bill 102. The public hearing on Senate Bill 102. If you will introduce yourself.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to be here. Senate Bill 102, like Senate Bill 101, is also designed to help property owners and taxpayers. It would allow the department to acquire land or an easement to provide replacement access from another property to a highway and then convey that to a proper, to a private owner. I've attached an illustration to my testimony to kind of show in a simplified form how this might look. You would have two adjacent properties with a state highway, and if the property on the right side of the illustration loses its access because of a construction project, this bill would give us the opportunity to acquire land in an easement through that second property, then convey it back to the first property owner. When access is closed to a property and becomes landlocked, we currently only have two options. We can offer to purchase it at the full market price or build a public road to replace that access. Public roads are a lot more expensive than driveways. In many cases, they would require curbs, gutters, sidewalks, different clearance issues, different kinds of materials because of the traffic volume that would be expected. Now, Senate Bill 102 would provide a third alternative. It would allow us to purchase this land or easement from another owner, for a landlocked owner, and then build it to driveway standards. This alternative would have a lot of benefits. Construction costs would be less. The property owner can control the use and connect to it, which they wouldn't be able to do with a public road. It would reduce liability and maintenance costs for the department, and perhaps more importantly, it would also reduce the number of landlocked properties, thus keeping them on the tax rolls. We have a recent example in Ontario that I think illustrates the kind of position we occasionally find ourselves in. Access acquisitions landlocked two properties, and there wasn't enough room for a public road, so we had to purchase it. In the process, several households were displaced, and we had to spend an estimated $162,000 that we wouldn't have otherwise had to spend. If we had had the Senate Bill 102 option, and the property owner was agreeing to it, we could have avoided this displacement and saved the costs at the same time. Our intent in this bill is to give us one more option to be as fair as possible to property owners who lose access because of the highway project. As you know, we're about to embark on an unprecedented expansion of construction projects across the state. We don't have any way of predicting how many times we might run into this, but if we do, we would like as many options possible to be as fair as possible to the property owners, and we respectfully request your support for this bill.
Senator Prezansky, would you ask your question again, just for the record, so it will make sense when you answer?
I would. I really appreciate that you gave us the illustration, because this really does demonstrate my question. If you take the property that's on the right,
mm-hmm.
that's losing its access, that's currently there, say that's property owner A, and if for some reason property owner B, let's say just didn't like property owner A, and they would not bargain and actually enter into an agreement to sell an easement to give that individual access, this bill would in fact give the department eminent domain provisions to actually take control of part of that property through that process.
Madam Chair, Senator Prezansky, that's correct.
And then what the property B owner would receive would be what we would consider the fair market value for the property that they were displaced?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, that's also correct. Using our existing processes to determine that value and compensate the property owner.
And besides that, they would get also the disgruntled, or if they're the disgruntled property owner, having property owner number A that much closer to their, to them.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Whitson is recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jackley. I don't understand that quite the same way. I believe you already have the power of eminent domain. You just don't have the power of providing eminent domain and then giving it to another person. And I have a problem with that issue because it sets a precedent. What if, you know, the next thing is that some municipality decides to use this as a precedent, using the domain to take out a neighborhood for a Red Meyer store or whatever. It's the same precedent. You're taking property by force from one individual and you're giving it to another private enterprise. The second issue that I have is has to do with equitable settlement, and that is the property owner losing access, in my mind, must not lose property value by the change of access. In the particular example that you showed us, that's very likely he would not. Had the access been provided but from a secondary road behind his property, then he would have lost property value, and that should be compensated.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitson, as to your first question, we would agree with the, of course, with the intent of what you said. We already do have that power of eminent domain. What we don't have, absent this bill, is the ability to then transfer that easement to the other property owner. So that is correct. With regards to the second issue, all of our acquisition proceedings are done according to state law, according to our established processes, and we do everything we can to not have to go to trial. I pulled together a couple of statistics. In 2003-2004, we had a total of 1,196 acquisitions. Out of that, we only started the process of condemnation and acquisition on 90 of them, which is less than 10%. And out of those nearly 1,200 acquisitions, only four actually went to trial. Our settlement rate is normally in the range of about 91-99%. And the intent of this bill is actually to give us an additional tool to make that property owner whole as best we can in terms of giving them access. The Ontario case was a good example. If we could have had this opportunity, excuse me, we would have had to purchase the property and we could have gotten a driveway access under this bill, and those families wouldn't have been displaced. We wouldn't have had to spend the extra money. We just see it as a tool to be more fair to the property owner, not as a way to additionally inconvenience them.
Okay. Other questions? If not, thank you very much, and I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 102. And committee, do you have any announcements for us of any kind? A week from Friday, right? Mm-hmm. All right. We're working on the trip out of town on February the 11th, and the details of that will be coming to you. We have offers of faster transportation for you, and I do think that it was very nice. We have been offered quicker transportation than the 6 hours, so by plane, is there anyone here that would not be willing to fly? Okay, Santa can ask. Okay, that's all right. We may have.
I might fly on the ground.
Yeah, well, that's all right. I have a driver that flies low. All right, excuse me.
Madam Chair, I guess the other thing regarding this, maybe we should talk to our community administrator as to what might be our preferences. It may be that I might need to be at a meeting that evening before in Eugene for the police commission, so I may want to see about leading Baker from there.
That would be very fine. I'm so glad that we planned it a little bit in advance, because we can work all of these details out with each one of you. And we'll be doing that very, very soon.
Maybe a low-flying vehicle as it passes by.
Well, if there's no other business to come before the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.